all good on earth is a reflection of the supreme good. Evil is merely the absence of good or distance from God. Now, the dramatist, having made us spellbound, and Shakespeare is able to do that to readers as well as spectators, is able to awake in us, through the evil that he shows us, a profound sense of the absence of good, and with it a profound nostalgia for good, which in its highest sense means love of God, or love of truth, one may say, or love of beauty, because all three are essential characteristics of the sovereign good. And here in this alchemy lies the meaning of the saying, I think it is of a Christian saint, but I can't remember, I forget who said it, the more he blasphemes, the more he praises. The more he blasphemes God, the more he praises God. Now, this alchemy of evil has its effect both on Lear and Gloucester. We see their contact with evil throughout the play. And that is one of the meanings of the descent into hell, one of the reasons why it is the necessary first stage of the mysteries, to know one's own faults and to be rid of them. Well, our nostalgia feeds on the good reactions of the servants, and we have another such relief awaiting us when Goneril returns home with Edmund. She sends him back to her sister, but not before she has made her love clear to him. And when he goes out, she says, "Oh, the difference between man and man. To thee a woman's services are due. My fool usurps my body." But then the fool, namely Albany, comes out. He is heard. He's not met Regan at the gate. He's not met Goneril, his wife, at the gate. He comes out. He has heard all about their treatment of the king. And he has now learned what Lear himself has learnt, and what Cordelia the fool and Kent have long known, the true nature of Goneril, a nature that she was at some pains to hide from him. She says, by way of comment, that he had not come, comment on the fact that he had not come out before to greet her, that he used to think her worthy of some consideration. He replies, "O Goneril, thou art not worth the dust which the rude wind blows in your face." And he goes on to condemn her total lack of filial piety. She stops him with the words, "No more, the text is foolish." But he will not be stopped. "Wisdom and goodness to the vile seem vile. Filth savour but themselves. What have you done? Tigers, not daughters, what have you performed? A father and a great..." This, in a sense, is a turning point in the play, for here is a man who has worldly power, speaking with the wisdom and goodness of Kent and Edgar. It is a brief foretaste of the final harmony at the end of the play, when Albany is left with all the power in his hands, the sole ruler, supported by Edgar, of a once more united Britain. Then a messenger comes from Regan, announcing her husband's death, and Goneril says aside, "One way I like this well." But then she goes on to say that, on the other hand, the idea of Regan being now free, a widow, and my Gloucester with her, may ruin all my plans. Because, of course, the death of Cornwall makes Regan's part of the land much less powerful. Regan would put it to rights, of course, with the help of Edmund, because as we learn later, she is already now herself passionately in love with Edmund, and he has sworn, as I say, sworn his love to both of them. The messenger tells Albany about Gloucester's eyes and Edmund's treachery, because Albany's immediate question is, but what was Edmund doing when his father's eyes were put out? And the messenger explains that he had left to give them freer rein to their actions. And Albany says, Gloucester, I live to thank thee for the love thou showedst the king, and to revenge thine eyes. And now to the fourth and the highest meaning, the anagogical meaning. Two old men preparing for death means much more than, from this point of view, than just preparing themselves to die in a state of grace, which would ensure salvation, because the only readiness for death from this point of view is sanctification. And therefore, the passage through the lesser mysteries, what the ancient world called the lesser mysteries. Shakespeare shows himself with all the religious problems of his day and the forbidding of the mention of the name of God on the stage. He shows himself quite at home going back to a previous age, a pre-Christian age. In King Lear, the gods are called upon, the plural, the gods. But they are God, they are truly divine. It's not a heathen, there's nothing heathen in the attitude of the characters in the play. They either believe or disbelieve in God. But it enables Shakespeare in a certain sense to be more universal. These puritanical vetoes and the other vetoes enable Shakespeare to speak in more general, more universal terms. The Winter's Tale is another example, which is set at the time of when Apollo's oracle was the chief recourse in matters of religion. Now, and so the mysteries, the passage through the mysteries, is what esotericism was known as in the ancient world, and the lesser mysteries comprise hell and purgatory. They correspond to the first two books of Dante's Divine Comedy. The greater mysteries are the way through the different degrees, the different celestial degrees to the supreme truth. But Shakespeare's tragedies are set in the domain of the lesser mysteries, and they consist of, first of all, the descent into hell, which the discovery of hidden faults and the transformations of them into virtues. And you can say that Lear's and Gloucester's characters develop throughout the play, and we see in Lear himself the virtues of spiritual poverty, that is, detachment from the world, developed against a background of worldly ambition. patience and resignation are developed against a background of bitterness and rebellion, humility against a background of pride, fidelity against a background of inconstancy, as he had shown himself to Cordelia in the first scene, and treachery, as is shown throughout the play. Love is developed against a background of hatred, kindness against a background of cruelty, discernment against a background of blindness, and truth against a background of untruth. And we see these qualities gradually develop in Lear and in Gloucester. Again, I come back to Lear's words to Cordelia in the first scene, "The truth then be thy dower." Lear has banished the truth. It can only remain in disguise, as it does in the fool, in Kent, who is disguised as a servant, and in Edgar, who is feigning madness as poor Tom the Bedlam. And Kent is immediately roped into the domain of folly by the fool. King Lear complains that he's not seen the fool for 2 days in an early scene, the first time we see him in Goneril's house. And a knight says to Lear that since our young lady's going into France, the fool has much pined away. Clearly the fool was very devoted to Cordelia. But he comes on, Lear sends for him. The fool, very fact that Lear has a fool is greatly to his credit. Of course, the fool was traditionally a monarch, had a fool at his court as a kind of discipline to prevent himself, to protect himself against flattery, against the results of flattery, namely vanity. It was to a man who has a fool, as King Lear already is somebody who is seriously bent on who has a sense of responsibility, shall we say. Of course, the fool became, and it's noticeable how much the fool is disliked by the bad characters in the play. Goneril hates to have the fool in her house, because the fool doesn't only talk to the king, only speak truth to the king. He speaks truth to everybody he comes in contact with, truths that people don't want to hear. And when he comes on, first of all, his first entry, King Lear speaks to him, "How dost thou, my boy?" and so on. He speaks to him affectionately. He hasn't seen him for some time. The fool completely ignores the king. But he takes off his coxcomb and gives it to Kent. "Here, take my coxcomb. Sirrah, you were best take my coxcomb." "Why, fool?" says Kent. "Why? For taking one's part that's out of favour." And he makes a gesture to Lear, indicating Lear. "Nay, and thou canst not smile as the wind sits, thou shalt catch cold shortly. There, take my coxcomb. Why, this fellow has banished 2 of his daughters and did the 3rd a blessing against his will. If thou follow him, thou must needs wear my coxcomb." It's a pity I can't dwell a bit longer on the fool, because it's such a wonderful character in the play. Such a mouthpiece of truth. For example, when Lear, it's a delight to see these scenes on the stage where the fool is, that Lear says to the fool on one occasion, rather threateningly, "Dost thou call me fool, boy?" And The fool says, all thine other titles thou hast given away, that thou wast born with. The title of fool, that thou wast born with. But Cordelia is present in both Kent and the fool. And we know that she's present in Kent because he defended her in the first scene, and when he's sitting in the stocks, when Cornwall puts him in the stocks, he takes out a letter to read, which is from Cordelia, who wants to know how her father is. Now, to go back to the mysteries and the descent into hell, this is manifested, that Shakespeare shows us this in different ways. There are one's children who can personify faults. Lear says to Goneril, when they are at Regan's house, when they're at Cornwall's house, but with Regan, but yet thou art, he can't deny her, he says, I cannot deny that you are my daughter, but yet thou art my flesh, my blood, my daughter, or rather a disease that's in my flesh, which I must needs call mine. Thou art a boil, a plague sore, an embossed carbuncle in my corrupted blood. He sees in the faults of his daughters his own faults, in a sense that he cannot, he admits, this is part of the descent into hell, he sees that he is to blame. It takes him a very long time to see how much he was to blame. He regrets having banished Cordelia. He expresses a certain regret, but he obviously doesn't see that he was so much to blame as he was. That takes time. Then the descent into hell, one aspect of it is shown in the state of the country, where Lear goes out into the storm, and he feels the power of the terrible weather, and thinks of the poor who have no protection against it. He exclaims, oh, I have ta'en too little care of this. And this refers directly to the houseless and unfed poor. But it may be taken also to refer to all else that he condemns in the country, such as lack of justice. And you can say that also hell is churned up by Edgar raving about the foul fiend. He's in fact stressing the truth for the benefit of Lear and his father, who is there part of the time, that fallen man is in the grip of Satan. The ideal of human perfection, which the lesser mysteries lead to, can be summed up in the words, priest king. That is the ideal of human perfection, which is the most universal way of putting it, because it's accepted from one end of the world to the other, and it was always accepted like that. And that is the virtual priest king who is saying, oh, I have ta'en too little care of this, or rather the virtual king, which is an element of kingliness, that it shows that Lear is on his way to true kingship. He's being fascinated, on the other hand, so much by Edgar, whom he calls my philosopher, the mad Edgar. That shows that he's on his way to priesthood. And you can say that the lesser mysteries as a whole lie in Lear's answer to Gloucester. There, Lear is mad at this point, and Gloucester is blind, of course. Gloucester says, "Oh, let me kiss that hand." And the king replies, "Let me wipe it first. It smells of mortality." And then it is the virtual priest-king who says to Gloucester, and Gloucester is in need of patience. Gloucester, understandably, when he's driven out of the house blind, his son, Edgar, who is leading him, hears him say, "As flies to wanton boys are we to the gods. They kill us for their sport." Because Gloucester has lost everything. And then Edgar cures him of this, as you remember, by this astonishing stratagem of... I just remind you briefly... Gloucester wants him to lead him to the Dover cliffs so that he can throw himself over. He wants nothing better than death. And Edgar leads him, says he will lead him to Dover cliff. And he leads him to a certain point and says, we are now at the edge of the cliff. And he describes what he sees to the king looking down, a wonderfully vivid description of what he can see looking down, how people down below look like mice, and so on. And then Gloucester puts up a prayer and throws himself forward, because he falls on the ground. And then Edgar comes and picks him up and says, Are you alive? Are your bones all right? And Gloucester says, Have I fallen? And Edgar says, "You've fallen from a tree." He describes looking up now. What is it? "You've fallen from the most tremendous height. And the gods, it's the gods who have saved you." He asks Gloucester, "Who was that with you at the top of the cliff?" And Gloucester said it was a man who was always talking about the devil. And Edgar replies, "I saw him with the devil's horns. It was clearly the devil that caused you to do this." And by that stratagem, he saves his father from this attitude towards the gods. And it is now the virtual, this is later than that, it is the virtual priest-king in Lear who says to Gloucester, "Thou must be patient. We came crying hither. Thou knowest the first time that we smell the air, we wall and cry. I will preach to thee, mark, when we are born. We cry that we are come to this great stage of fools." Now, one can say that, and this occurs to many of occurs in many of Shakespeare's plays, spiritual wisdom, from a worldly point of view, seems mad, and Shakespeare often allows madness, be it real, feigned, or professional, as with a fool, to represent spiritual wisdom. Madness in itself, in fact, is what one might call an escape from the rut of ordinary mental processes. The fact that it is nearly always in life in a downward direction is quite irrelevant to the plays. It can be also in an upward direction. But it is only in the world when Cordelia is banished that wisdom has to appear in the guise of folly. There is no place for wisdom in itself. But when Cordelia, when in Cordelia's presence, when she is back and she is now in Dover herself, it's natural that Leah should recover his sanity and be wise at the same time. We have seen his wisdom in his folly. But at first, Leah refuses to see Cordelia. He's still mad, but they tell him, he understands enough, they tell him Cordelia is there. He absolutely refuses to see her. He's too ashamed. His madness does not stop his remembering how much he had wronged her. But finally, they manage to persuade him to come with them, and they take him to the house, and the doctor gives him some sleeping draught, as far as I can remember. He has a deep sleep, and the doctor thinks that he will wake up sane, which is what he does. And it's often said that that scene, when he wakes in Cordelia's presence, is the most tear-compelling scene in all Shakespeare's plays. You have to read it for yourself. But it is a wonderful experience to even when we see Cordelia, because of the evil that is put before us and our nostalgia for good, when actually Cordelia first comes onto the stage after so long an interval in the last act, when she appears on the stage, it's I think a legitimate anachronism. I've seen it done like that very effectively. Cordelia as Queen of France, which she is, dressed in a robe of fleur-de-lis, a blue robe of gold or silver fleur-de-lis. You can see immediately who it is. It's extraordinary. It was extraordinarily effective, I remember, in this production. I can't remember which production it was. But it's amazing what Shakespeare can do silently, without words. The very sight of Cordelia at the end of the play, when she first appears, is something absolutely wonderful. And this scene is extremely, it is one of the most moving scenes imaginable. And one's conscious that when Leah wakes, he really is, he has attained to human perfection. He is really the great priest king that he should be. Now, just one or two points before we come to the end. There's a question of Edmund's repentance. When he is dying, it is Edgar who kills him in a duel, who challenges him, and Edgar tells Albany of his own story, what he's been doing all these, it's only weeks, I suppose, since he himself was outlawed. And he says to Kent, to Edmund, who is lying wounded, mortally wounded there, about his father, about their father. The dark place where he thee got cost him his eyes. He's saying that not moralistically, but in a, to point out to Edmund that there is such a thing as what the Far Easterners call the law of concordant actions and reactions, that everything that one does has inevitably a result in time. And when he says that to Edmund, Edmund replies, "It is true. The wheel has come full circle. I am here." And that needs explaining, I think. When he says, "I am here," he means, I would say, a young man in the prime of life, struck down in the moment of success. Clearly, that is clearly a retribution for my sins. I recognize it. The wheel has come full circle. There was that idea that the wheel of time brought with it these concordant reactions caused by the actions. And the wheel has come full circle. That means, yes, all my philosophy is shown to be false. I see that tradition is true about these questions, these principles. I don't see how else to explain it, because it's very elliptical. And then, after a few minutes, he says, "I mean to do some good despite my nature. Send to the castle at once. My writ is on the life of Cordelia." He has told a man to hang Cordelia and to make it appear that it was her own act of despair. And Edmund is very insistent that they should do so. He tells them to hurry, go quickly, and he clearly wishes to do some good. And they say, "How shall we, what sign can we have?" And he says, "Take my sword, give it to the captain as a sign." But of course it's too late. And the body of Edmund is carried out, and Lear comes in carrying Cordelia dead in his arms. And it is, of course, an amazing situation. Lear's hoping that she might be still alive. But meantime, I should just mention that Albany has said, because they have won the battle, and when Edmund has been killed, when Edmund has been wounded, fatally wounded, Albany takes the letter that he had intercepted between Goneril and Edmund, Goneril telling Edmund to be sure to kill by some means or other Albany, so that they can get married, so that she will be free and they can get married. Meantime, she has poisoned her sister. And when Edmund is wounded, mortally wounded, Goneril realizes that her husband knows the truth, and that all her plans have failed. She goes out and stabs herself. And Albany says, "I will resign all my power to the king during his life." He intends to give the king back all his power so long as he's alive. But then the king comes on with Cordelia, and he says, "If she be alive, it is a chance which does redeem all sorrows that I have ever felt." And then he sees that she's there's no hope that she is dead. Why should a horse, a dog, a rat have life, and thou no breath at all? But then he looks at her again and says, do you see this? Look on her, look, her lips, look there, look there. And he dies at that moment. And Bradley, the great Shakespearean scholar, said that there can be absolutely no doubt that Lear, in these words, was convinced that Cordelia was alive and that he died of joy for that reason. That he died because of that. But is it not more probable that it is the other way around? You see, Shakespeare in Hamlet, he is not content. The play takes up the whole of the play is taken up with the lesser mysteries. But at the end of Hamlet, when Horatio says to Hamlet, good night, sweet prince, and flights of angels sing thee to thy rest, that is the greater mysteries, at least brought in at the end. And we have, I feel sure, the same thing in this play, but in a different form. It's not that Lear dies for joy at seeing that Cordelia is alive. It's because he is dead, or as good as dead, that he sees she is alive for the life hereafter. And that again is the greater mysteries, is the hint of the greater mysteries in this play. Well, that's all I can say, all I, well, not all I can say, but it's all I will say.